When I pulled off of I-95 near Augusta, Maine, I needed gas and caffeine. But something else was even more pressing. The cover of E.B. White's book, One Man's Meat, that I had torn off and affixed to my passenger seat, was falling off. Before I did anything else, I duct-taped the beloved children's author and essayist back where he belonged. I needed White for the 14-hour trek from my Maryland home to his adopted hometown, Brooklyn, Maine. As I was getting out of my car, the guy parked next to me peered in my passenger window. What's up with the picture on your seat? He asked in his clipped Maine accent. Is it a memorial? It was, sort of. The image shows White in his clean, Spartan boathouse overlooking Blue Hill Bay's Allen Cove, pecking away at his Underwood typewriter. He writes at a sharp-edged wooden table while sitting on an equally stiff, angular bench, which looks more like a pew, really. In characteristic fashion, he sidesteps the limelight, seating the camera's focal point to a large open window filled with pine trees and salt water, the essence of what White considered real artistry, nature. For decades, this photograph of White at work, Oxford shirt sleeves rolled up, has served as a consecrated reminder to me of the Holy Trinity required for good writing and good living. Bare forearms, bare floors, simple truth. This was what I was after in searching for E.B. White. I wanted to step into that photograph. I pulled up to the main house at Bear Springs Camp, which sits on a sloping ridge overseeing North Bay and the camps. The multi-gabled, low-slung farmhouse was splashed white with red roof and shutters. The front door led to the dining room, and I tried not to interrupt diners who were finishing dessert, cranberry gingerbread buckle. On a wall near a taxidermied moose head, the closest I've come to seeing this animal in my more than 20 years of travels to Maine, I came across another elusive species. An unmarked photograph of E.B. White. There he was, paddling close to shore in his beloved Old Town canoe, wearing a pork pie hat and aviator sunglasses, his long-sleeve Oxford shirt unbuttoned, revealing his bare, aged torso. The photograph looked to have been taken slightly before or on his 81st birthday, the last trip he made to Bear Spring. White was, as he admits in Once More to the Lake, a saltwater man as an adult. But as he wrote, there are days when the restlessness of the tides and the fearful cold of the seawater and the incessant wind which blows make me wish for the placidity of a lake in the woods. Since his Belgrade memories, which dated to 1904 when he was 5 years old or so, had been, as he wrote, infinitely precious and worth saving, he returned often, alone with Joel in his youth, and after his wife Catherine passed away, with his Harper and Row editor Corona Matchemer. If there was any part of Maine that left its most defining imprint on his psyche, this was it. I walked down the small hill along the old cow path, past the lone tennis court, to the lake. More than 70 years after White wrote his renowned essay about this place, precious little seemed changed. An early evening mist took advantage of the break in rain to stake its claim on North Bay, nearly shrouding a lone fisherman in a skiff, perhaps 300 yards offshore. I was suddenly overcome with a compulsion of religious proportions to enter the water. I turned toward the shoreline littered with overturned canoes. I found an Old Town canoe, flipped it over, and dragged it a few feet. When I looked up, I saw that the mist had spread and thickened in mere seconds, as often happens in Maine. Whoa, I thought, as if I had just woken from sleepwalking. I can't take someone else's canoe. But I could step into the familiar frame that surely White had witnessed many times over the years. I dropped the canoe, ran to the shore, and waded into the cold water, plunging under for a few seconds. And when I breached the surface, gasping, I felt reborn. Mention the name E.B. White to most people, And if they recognize it, they make the connection with his classic children's books, Stuart Little, The Trumpet of the Swan, and especially Charlotte's Web. But it was his personal essays on life in Maine that still generate impassioned outbursts from writers, English teachers, and bloggers. And this was the case for me. Sure, like everyone else, I cozied to his witty, playful tone and his graceful way with a sentence. But what really hooked me? His inaudible sighs. I had never encountered an essayist on such friendly terms with melancholy. I wasn't after the Lobster Freeport outlet shopping side of Maine. I was looking for the coastal life that White had written about with such love, affection, and at times loss in books such as One Man's Meat and in essays such as Death of a Pig. And I was looking for the writer who went out of his way to devise a children's book, Charlotte's Web, because, as he wrote, I needed a way to save a pig's life after one had died at his own hands years earlier. Back in the late 1990s, I first set out to find White's North Brooklyn home, and my many requests for directions were basically met with, "Mr. White doesn't appreciate uninvited visitors." Even though White had been dead since 1985, the community was still doing his bidding. White loathed contact with his public. He agreed with Louisa May Alcott, who wrote in a letter that her books belonged to the public, but her private life was hers, and she'd be considered, as she wrote, sacred by the world. Somehow, I found the home on that visit, and the present owners were terribly gracious, letting me roam the grounds of the saltwater farm. But the sense that an entire village was giving me the bum's rush made the experience feel as if I were visiting an art exhibit with hundreds of people behind me. It's hard to know what you're looking at and what it means when the impatience of enmity is breathing down your neck. And besides, it felt disrespectful to pursue someone who demanded privacy even from the grave. But therein lay the seeker's dilemma. To whom does he owe his deepest allegiance? To himself or to his North Star? On Route 175, I saw the sign, "Welcome to Brooklyn, boat building capital of the world." If I wanted to find vestiges of White in Brooklyn, a place where sailboats were built and restored would be a good start. While he was a lifelong canoeist, White also loved sailing. Throughout his life, he kept a slew of boats at the ready for single-handed sailing, and he wrote an essay that recounted his obsession about it. But another reason that Brooklyn Boatyard proved a good place to stop was because it had been owned and operated by his son Joel, a world-renowned naval architect. Since Joel had passed away in 1997, his son Steve, White's grandson, had taken control of the business. A burly mustachioed guy who looks part President Theodore Roosevelt and part New York Mets great Keith Hernandez, Steve White gave me a tour and showed me one of his greatest treasures. In one of the storage areas, he removed a tarp, and there lay Shadow, the first sailboat his father had bought, a Harrishoff 12.5 he purchased when he was 16 in 1946. Steve White refurbished it and repainted it black, its original color. I asked him if his grandfather spent a lot of time at the boatyard, and he shook his head. "He wasn't a hardcore sailor," Steve said. "He would go out, often by himself, for 4 or 5 hours at a time, but he wasn't an adventurous sailor. He liked the peace of it." After Steve White excused himself, I walked down to a narrow beach and came across part of an old wooden pylon. It was coated with calcified barnacles, the kind I imagined E.B. White was referring to when he was 64 and wrote about his lifelong love of sailing in the essay, "The Sea and the Wind That Blows." It ends on a slightly overcast note. White wrote, "I'll feel again the wind imparting life to a boat. will smell again the old menace, the one that imparts life to me, the cruel beauty of the salt world, the barnacle's tiny knives, the claw of the crab. The rain began yet again as I drove back through town, and I sought temporary relief in Friend Memorial Library. If a public homage exists to Catherine and E.B. White in Brooklyn, then Friend Memorial Library is it. Above the card catalog, which some people still use, hung two framed original Garth Williams drawings for White's first children's book, Stuart Little. When White dismantled his New Yorker office in 1968, he knew exactly where he wanted the artwork to go. He wrote in a letter, "I'd rather give them to this library than to any other place." White even used the library to score brownie points with Catherine, a tireless advocate and trustee of the tiny library for decades. He knew Catherine's concern about the vacant Earl Firth house, which sat near the library and posed a fire threat. He lavished Catherine with a check to have the house demolished. White wrote, "So I now have the strong desire to make you a gift in lieu of rubies, and it seemed to me the other night that the thing you most wanted was to tear down Earl Firth's house. So I am giving you that, my love, my own. Hit it hard and true." The librarian suggested I check out the wildflower garden outside, dedicated to the Whites, or the main section in the back of the library, which featured 22 titles by or about White. Few, if any, public libraries own White's extensive collection. As charming as all of this was, I had to admit the hard truth. Yes, I had wangled my way deeper into White's mane and had experienced a presence of being with his spirit that I hadn't known before. But the journey still felt disembodied, as if only half of me had made it into White's framed vision. I reached for the last book at one end of the shelf, a tattered copy of The Trumpet of the Swan, and noticed something familiar next to it, the photograph of White in his boathouse. Leaving Brooklyn, I passed a large colonial with manicured wildflower gardens. This looked like the White farm from my memories. A few seconds later, I made a U-turn in the road and headed back, pulling off on a side road a half mile or so away. There are few, if any, places to park on Brooklyn's roads outside of the village, and this is the way that police and locals like it. I walked back up along the narrow stretch of grass separating the pine woods from the road. A few hundred yards past the colonial, a police car pulled over. "Can I help give you a ride somewhere, sir?" the policeman bellowed. "These roads aren't meant for pedestrians." "No, thank you," I replied. "I don't think you're getting the picture," he said, lifting his sunglasses. His steely blue eyes were set. "You can't just walk down this road. You getting the picture?" I looked around. I'm going down there," I said, pointing to a dirt path ahead that cut into the woods. He flipped down his sunglasses and drove off. I took the path that led toward the water and bushwhacked through the woods until I came to another path next to a verdant golf course-trimmed field. A White scow floated on a small nearby pond, and beyond that lay a large barn. If memory served, this was it. The barn that has captured the imagination of Charlotte's Web pilgrims for more than half a century. I followed the path for maybe half a mile, past low bush blueberry shrubs, and Allen Cove exploded in front of me. Off to the right, a small privately owned, cedar-shingled cottage faced the cove, the boathouse. I walked through the White frame doorway, and there was the old Franklin stove at one end, the one that White had written about in One Man's Meat that housed his office mate, a mouse. And off to the left, there it was, the table and the bench. I tried to envision White sitting there, typing up notes and comment for the New Yorker, but the magnetic pull was just too overpowering to keep standing. So I eased myself down onto the bench, which really did feel like a pew, and laid my fingers on the table near where the underwood had rested. The window was open, and from outside, seagulls called. Three of them stood atop an Adirondack chair a few feet away, glaring squarely at me. For one brief moment, I occupied E.B. White's frame. All of it. Watching Allen Cove and Harriman Point appear through the dissipating fog, I rooted further into the hardwood surfaces. I closed my eyes and inhaled deeply, my nose tingling from a dram of pine and low tide. I was baptized by the peace of it all. Now I could leave.
Andrew Reiner teaches freshman writing at Towson University. He's presently teaching creative writing and literature as well in the Honors College. Reiner also teaches creative writing in the Odyssey program at Johns Hopkins University, and his essays have appeared on the Atlantic Magazine's website, in Urbanite Magazine, and in the Baltimore Sun.